Today is November 3rd, 2018, and my name is Deborah Schwartz. On behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Public Library, I am speaking right now with musician Jesse Barish. Now, Jesse, first of all, I just want to make clear that you're sitting in Venice in California, and I'm here in Mill Valley in my house, and we're connecting by phone, so I don't get to see your face, but I'm very happy to have your voice.
Okay, thank you.
And I'm hoping we don't have too much feedback here. Jesse, you're a musician, a composer, and a wonderful performer, still performing. Many of us have heard your songs over the years and may or may not have known that they originated with you, and that's something we can talk about with this interview. In addition, you've spent a lot of time here in Mill Valley, and that's something I'd like to talk about too today.
Okay.
But first, let's get a little context about you and your family. Can you tell me about where your ancestors came from and how it is you came to live in California? Because you sound like you have a little bit of an Eastern accent from New York, I think, correct?
Right, correct. The roots of my family are from Latvia, Romania, Russia, the old country, wherever that is. And we ended up in Brooklyn. My family, my mother's family and my father's family are all from Brooklyn. That's where I grew up, in Brownsville. And that was in the 40s and 50s, so it was a really incredible time to grow up in Brooklyn then. You know, now all the hipsters are moving to Brooklyn, but back then it was truly a magical place for a kid to be, just a melting pot of cultures. You know, I grew up in a Jewish, Puerto Rican, black neighborhood, so I had all those influences on me. And then when I was about 15, we moved up to when I was about nine, we left Brooklyn and moved up to a little town in the Catskill Mountains called Liberty, which was kind of the resort, the Jewish Alps, they called them, you know, the Borscht Belt, where my mother had spent part of her youth in the 20s, and she always wanted to go back to live there. And my father found a job, and we were nine, we moved up to Liberty, where I spent a lot of my formative, what I call Leave It to Beaver years, you know, the idyllic 50s. You know, it was really an amazing time to live in this small town. It was about an hour and a half from Brooklyn. My father died suddenly when I was 15, and from a cerebral hemorrhage. He wasn't sick or anything like that, and soon after that, we left Liberty and moved to Miami Beach, where my mother had a sister, and that's where I finished high school. And when I got out of high school in 1963, I headed for California, and that began my journey here. You know, I drove across country with my brother-in-law, came to the Golden Coast of California, and that's where my California adventure began. And so I lived in L.A. I got married really young, moved up to San Francisco in the Haight-Ashbury, and lived there in the 60s when it was happening. When Marty was king of the world, I was living in the Haight and doing my dance in the hippie, you know, in the hippie world. And in the early 70s, I found myself back in Los Angeles, where I got signed to Shelter Records, which was like a Leon Russell's label. And I had a band. It was called Jesse Wolf and Wings. We made one album for Shelter Records. And there were more clubs to play in the Bay Area, so we moved up to Marin, first to San Anselmo, then I lived in first to Larkspur, and then I moved to San Anselmo, and in the early 70s found myself in Mill Valley, which is where this part of the interview deals. deals with my time in Marin and Mill Valley in the 70s.
Okay, so that's a pretty good overview, Jesse. Let's unpack just a little bit of that information before we progress on to Mill Valley. You talked about your very early years in Brooklyn with your family. Can you please give me your parents' names and any siblings that you may have?
My parents' name, my father was Albert, my mother was Hilda. I have a sister, Linda, who's 4 years older than me and who lives in not too far away in the valley. I live in Venice. She lives in Studio City.
And when you described the magic of living in Brooklyn, this is something that, unless you've been there, I think you can't truly understand the smells, the atmosphere, the general ambiance of that time. Could you just describe an afternoon or some kind of childhood experience vividly? Take us back there and just give us an idea of what that was like living in Brooklyn with the Jews and the Puerto Ricans
And the blacks. Yeah, I can remember, you know, there was the grocery store with the pickle barrel, you know, where you'd go and there was the candy store across the street where I would, you know, rot my teeth out and with the latest candy I could find. And, you know, summer days outside, the fire hydrants, the fire companies would turn the hydrants on, kids would, you know, that was a big deal, and a good humor truck going by, you get your, fudgesicle or whatever, and sitting outside on a summer night in Brooklyn, and I remember gospel groups with tambourines singing, and, you know, everyone kind of hanging together, and, you know, this was the late 1940s, early 50s, and, right around then, there was a great migration out of Brooklyn to the suburbs. Some people moved up to Long Island or to Westchester, or we moved to Liberty because the streets were getting a little dangerous. There were a lot of gangs, but Brooklyn was, it just had a certain melting pot. It was, it had such a colorful vibration about it. There were a trolley car was right outside my window. We lived in the same apartment for like 9 years. The first 9 years, it was like a tiny little, my sister and I shared a bedroom. My mom and dad pulled out a thing in the living room, a sofa bed, and that's where they slept. You know, we were, you know, I don't know what we considered. We weren't wealthy at all. We were, you know, lower middle class Jews living in Brownsville.
And what did your dad do for a living?
My dad actually played the violin, but he ended up being an accountant. And then he always had two or three jobs. You know, he worked at a racetrack in Monticello, worked for a plumbing supply. But his true love was music. He wanted to, you know, be a classical musician, and maybe that's why I was so determined to live my life and live my dreams, because I saw my dad die really young and wanting to, you know, not living out his destiny of being an artist. You know, I think he was, wasn't a happy guy, and I guess in his mid-40s, he was 45, and he had a cerebral hemorrhage, never sick a day in his life that I can remember, never saw him stay home from work. He just went to work one day and dropped me off at school, and that was the last I saw him.
Oh, could be very traumatic for a young boy to lose a father.
Well, I was 15, 14, and then lose your dad, you know, and my sister was already out of the house. She was living in Manhattan working for advertising agencies. That was the big thing back then, you know, the Mad Men era.
Mad Men, right.
She was working for all the big advertising agencies, you know, J. Walter Thompson, Benton and Bowles. She did all that, but she was already out of the house. So when my dad passed, it was just me and my mom.
Mm-hmm. And then the Catskills, where you went afterwards to live in this small town, which is so different from Brooklyn. Give us an idea of what that was like, just as you've done so beautifully with Brooklyn.
Say that again?
Just as you've just described so perfectly your Brooklyn experience in just such a short time. It's vivid. I could almost imagine the quality of light and the kids running around the street and the smells and the and the noise.
Yeah, like it was, and Liberty was like a small town, maybe 5,000 people. It was kind of like the heart of the Catskills, you know, which was the Jewish resort. At one point, there were over 500 hotels and bungalow colonies, you know, and the usual drill was if you were living in Brooklyn during the summer, you would go to a bungalow colony, you and your mom and your siblings, and your dad would stay in the city working, and he would come up on weekends. You know, that was kind of the thing, the bungalow colony thing. But like I said, my mom had lived in this town in the 20s during the Depression. I don't know how she ended up there. My grandfather, her father, owned a cigar store in Liberty. So her dream was always to go back to Liberty and to relive her childhood. So one day my dad found a job in the New York Times in Liberty and went up and interviewed. It was for a plumbing supply company, and we moved to Liberty.
Were your grandparents Jewish immigrants? Had they come from the old country, or were they born and raised in the United States?
My mother's parents, I think they were born here. I think it was my great-grandparents came from the old country. I'm not really quite sure. My sister is kind of the family historian, so I'd have to ask her. But I never got to meet my mother's father. But my mother's mother always lived either with us or near us in Brooklyn. And then when we moved to, she lived in Brooklyn, she lived in the same building that we lived in. And then when we moved up to Liberty, she was with us. That was my maternal grandmother.
And her name?
Anna Weiss.
And your sister's name?
Linda.
This, you know, when you're describing this, it reminds me of the movie Dirty Dancing.
Yeah, well, that's where it was. That Dirty Dancing was in the Catskills, and this was, you know, resort hotels, you know, Grossinger, the Concord, those were the big hotels, and then there were smaller hotels and then really small, tiny hotels, and, you know, I spent my teenage years working in those hotels as a busboy. I was an elevator operator, but Liberty was the quintessential little town, for me anyway. It was, you know, it was the idyllic 50s Elvis, you know, the American Bandstand, you know, the idyllic life of childhood. You know, I went from Brooklyn to this little town that was, you know, a really sweet little place, and it was still close enough to the city that, you know, we would, every weekend, we would drive to Brooklyn from Liberty to see my father's sister, my Aunt Helen. We drive to from Liberty to Brooklyn. That was our Sunday ritual. If not every week, then every other weekend, we drive down for the day, and my Aunt Helen would have this huge spread with all of my father's family there. You know, his parents, my paternal grandparents lived with my father's sister.
And their names?
My their names was Sam and Becky. Mm-hmm. Those were my paternal grandparents, and my father's Aunt Helen was my father's sister. And so even when we lived in Liberty, we would make weekly or semi bi-monthly trips to New York, to Brooklyn for the day, where we would have this big family spread of, you know, Jewish deli food and you know, pastries and you know.
Like what kind? What's a meal for you back then? The good New York Jewish food.
Oh, you know, I would make myself a roast beef sandwich, corned beef, you know, pastrami. I would go with my grandfather. We would go to the bakery when we got to Brooklyn and you know, buy all the bagels and bialys and whitefish, lox. You know, I mean, the table was spread every week. It was just like it was a bar mitzvah. You know, it was. And I had cousins and relatives, and it was like a beautiful thing, you know. And then we'd get in the car and drive back to Liberty. So it was like Liberty was like a bedroom community of Brooklyn in many ways.
Mm-hmm. I forgot to ask you what year you were born, Jesse.
I was born in 1945.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I experienced, you know, the 40s, the 50s, 60s. I've experienced many decades.
Mm-hmm. So then all of a sudden you go from Liberty to Miami.
Right, and that was kind of a shock because, you know, I'm in Liberty and I'm with people that I had made friends with. I'd been there for, you know, maybe 6 years, and then my father died suddenly. And I remember I got called out of class. It must have been my father had dropped me off at school. I got called out of class. Someone came and with a note that I should go to the office, and then I went to the principal's office. You know, that was always kind of frightening for a kid. What did I do now? And they said, oh, there's somebody who wants to speak with you outside the school. This was in Liberty, and I walked outside. It was snowing. It was like January, middle of winter in upstate New York, freezing cold. And I walked outside, and there was some guy. Never saw him before. Apparently, he worked at my father's office, and he said to me, I remember he said, you know, you have to be really brave, son. Your father just died. And that was pretty, you know. And then I went with him. We drove back to my house where my mother had already had gotten the news. My sister was on her way up from Manhattan. And, you know, that was the beginning of the, you know, then several months after that, we moved from this little town where I had all my friends, and I thought I was going to graduate from that. You know, I was in the middle of the 10th grade, and my mom decides to move to Miami Beach, swing in Miami Beach, you know. It was a swing in town back then, even then.
It was a moment of punctuated equilibrium, where in one moment there was one life, and then there was another, I suppose.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden it thrust into the middle of the 10th grade in Miami Beach, where, you know, all these kids that grew up together, and I was the, you know, that, you know how traumatic that can be for a kid, right, to change schools.
And when you say swing in Miami, describe what swing in
Miami Beach was like. I mean, you know what Miami Beach is like now, South Beach.
Yes.
That whole club scene. Well, when I lived in Miami Beach, it was the same thing. It was swinging hotels, people on holiday, and South Beach is funny enough was like considered the slum. South of Lincoln Road was considered, you know, where all the old Jewish people lived in retirement hotels, and those hotels now are like $600 a night hotels. But back then, you know, we used to call it Bagel Beach. So, you know, that's where all the old Jews lived, and I mean, Miami Beach was primarily a Jewish ghetto that, like all the places I lived, you know, Brownsville, Liberty, and Miami Beach. You know, I did the Jewish ghetto, you know, circuit.
And then you end up in California. And how was it for you when you went to Southern California before you came here?
Well, when I drove out here with my brother-in-law, this was 1963, I tried to go to college for a couple of days in Miami. Went to Miami Dade Junior College, and I just wasn't cut out for college. You know, wasn't my thing. Just so somehow we decided to go to California. So my brother-in-law, my sister's husband, and I drove across the country in a '61 Falcon with this giant console TV tied to the roof, like the Beverly Hillbillies. I don't know what we were thinking, but we drove across the country. We ended up in L.A. And this was '63, right before Kennedy was killed. You know.
And your brother-in-law's name?
Ted LeBove. My sister, they're still married. I saw him last week. It was my sister's son's wife who passed away that I came back to the funeral for.
So those that are listening to this, they won't know, but you and I met a couple of weeks ago for the first time, although we've been in communication, because of Marty Balin, and that's someone we'll talk about in a little bit, because of his memorial and here in San Francisco, and we attended the memorial together at at the Temple in Emmanuel, and then you had to go home to attend another memorial, your sister's daughter-in-law who died.
Right, that was the funeral. It was, you know, I actually, you know, Marty was cremated, and Jody, my sister's daughter-in-law, was, you know, buried in a Jewish cemetery. So
that was was quite a weekend, but we
quite a weekend. A lot of driving, a lot of thinking, a lot of leaving the past behind. You know.
Yes, and that's something we can talk about too, because I recall as you arrived, you stayed in my house, and the shock when you saw Mill Valley so very changed from the Mill Valley you remember. So let's go back to the Mill Valley that you lived in. This is a great time for us to segue into the 60s now, is that, or the 70s. How long were you in L.A. for?
I was in L.A. for, I don't know, some 63 to 65, 66. Then I, you know, I lived in Venice then. When I got married really young, I married my college sweetheart, you know.
Her name?
Deborah Abbott. So I did end up going to college for a little while in L.A. in the Valley, in L.A. Valley College. I didn't know what else to do with myself. I wasn't really writing songs yet. I was more of a jazz kind of guy. I played the flute, and I still play the flute, by the way. I originally wanted to be a jazz musician. That was my real love, my musical place where I felt comfortable. But I met a girl at this cafeteria at Valley College, and we, you know, smoked a lot of dope together and took LSD and got married.
When you were in Venice Beach at that time, I mean, the Jim Morrison and the Doors.
Yeah, that was the time. I lived in Venice Beach in 1965. Had a little apartment on right in the heart of Venice, $65 a month, believe it or not, for a one-bedroom apartment, which is probably now $3,000 a month or more. And Venice was transitioning from the beat generation into the hippie thing, which I always thought was an interesting segue. You know, I always thought of myself as a beatnik. You know, I was more of a beat poet, kind of jazz guy, and you know, I was smoking pot, and then, you know, the LSD thing kind of turned it into the hippie thing. It was like beatniks on acid.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so I didn't even know there was no name for this group of people. Like when I was living in Venice, there were, you know, maybe 10 people like me and my wife at the time. You know, we were kind of colorful, taking LSD, smoking weed, listening to, you know, all kinds of music. It was a freedom and an amazing time. The boardwalk was again mostly old Jewish people living in retirement places. Wherever I went, there were those old Jewish people. No, I'm one of them. How did this happen? Those that have been following me.
I really can't imagine two more diverse scenes than Brooklyn and Venice Beach with the weightlifters and
the California dreaming. Yeah, it's funny because Venice is the place most like Brooklyn in L.A., even now, because, you know, it's the only place in L.A. where there's a vibrant street scene, you know, which is what I gravitate towards. You know, I'm a people person, so, you know, I live a half a block from the boardwalk. I live a half a block from the craziest circus you'd ever want to see. But when I'm home, it's quiet. Like, I'm home now, half a block away are like hundreds of thousands of people searching for God knows what.
So let's get back on the road trip that brings you to the Bay Area.
Okay.
And now, and do you have?
No,
your...
I end up in San Francisco in the 60s.
Wait! I'm going to interrupt you for a second, because we haven't really talked about your musical ability, which is amazing. Before we progress into your life as a musician here in the Bay Area, tell me, when did your interest in music begin?
You know, my earliest things was a musical thing in Brooklyn. I really wanted to play the trumpet, and I actually tried to build a trumpet out of an Erector set, which is virtually impossible. But my father came home one day with a rented trumpet for me. I must have been about maybe 5 or 6, and I started taking trumpet lessons, and I even have a piece of music that my mother saved that I transcribed a song off the radio. I don't know if you remember a song, Oh My Papa, by Eddie Fisher.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that song?
Yes. Maybe you could sing a couple of words.
Oh, my papa, to me, he was so wonderful. Anyway, it was like a Jewish song. I don't know what it was.
A tearjerker, for sure.
What's that?
It's a tearjerker.
Yeah, and I figured out the notes, and I wrote them down. You know, it wasn't like I was Beethoven or anything. I just, had an ear for music. And then all through, grade school, and I was playing the clarinet, I was in the band, and I hated it. I just thought it was something I was supposed to do, but I didn't like reading music. I wasn't good at reading music. I didn't like performing I played in the drum and bugle corps. Music was always a part of my life. And then I got interested in jazz when I was a young teenager, which was pretty unusual for white kids back then, but it kind of captured me. Then I wanted to be a jazz musician. And when I was about 17, I bought a flute and taught myself to play the flute. And somewhere along the line, I got it in my head that I could write songs. I this was when Dylan came out and the Beatles, Rubber Soul. And somehow I was captivated by the idea of playing the guitar and writing songs. And I'd been like a jazz guy, a purist, and so all of a sudden I want to be a folk singer, and I feel like I've got this thing inside of me to write songs, which apparently I did. And so I started fooling around with the guitar pretty late, like I was maybe 19 or 20 when I actually got a guitar and started working on the process of learning how to write songs,
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you bring this, what appears to me in listening to you, a natural gift. You had an interest and you had an ability that flourished with time, so maybe you weren't Beethoven, but you obviously had some natural abilities.
Yeah, I had a deep feeling for music, but it took me a long time. I must have written 100 really, really bad songs before I wrote one song that I thought was okay. Here's a melody. Here's a real song.
Mm-hmm.
It took me a long time to master the craft of writing songs.
So you bring what you have musically with you as you come to the Bay Area, and then tell me about that.
Well, I ended up in, like I said, I was in the Hay in the mid-60s during the golden time of the Haight-Ashbury. I was in a band called The Orchestra, which spawned some interesting people. There was David LaFlame, was the violin player in that band, who went on to have It's a Beautiful Day. Jamie Leopold was the bass player, who went on to play with Dan Hicks. And the leader of that band, believe it or not, was Bobby Beausoleil, who became one of the infamous Manson people,
Manson as in
Charlie.
Ooh.
He was this was before that whole time, but mm-hmm. this was in 1965, and Bobby was just a kid from Santa Barbara who was putting a band together, and in this band was David LaFlame, and I didn't stay that long with the band, but I stayed for a few months and rehearsed with them, and then left the Haight and moved up to the Russian River, because that's where all the hippies went to the country when they left, the Haight when it became too commercial.
Mm-hmm.
And the buses were driving down Haight Street looking at the freaks, so all the hippies and the first generation people left and moved to Marin or Sonoma. I went up to the Russian River, and that was kind of where I started writing songs, and my wife became pregnant in 68. My son was born in 1968, and we lived in Oakland for a while, and then back in Venice and back and forth, and we ended up in Hollywood in the early 70s, where I got signed by this label, and I'd only been writing songs literally for a couple of years. It was kind of a shock. I wasn't even looking for a record deal. I got signed by Shelter Records, and that's what brought me up to Marin, you know, was because there were more gigs up in Marin. There was the Lion's Share, there was Keystone Berkeley, there were more venues for us to play, so the band and myself, we ended up in Marin. That's right about when I ended up in Mill Valley.
When did you begin your collaboration with Marty Balin of Jefferson Airplane?
We began in probably in 73, 74. I had a mutual friend who said, you know, you ought to meet Marty. And he was moving to L.A., and right before he left, he took me to Marty's house, that was the beginning of it, you know? And then Marty had this little house on Blythedale Avenue, and that was an amazing scene. You never know who you were going to run into when you went over to Marty's house. You know, it could have been Grace, it could have been Paul Kantner, it could have been anybody in the world, you know? It was just that kind of, Marty was like a magnet it was like a salon, from the 20s. It was a fascinating scene. And we just, we didn't write that many songs together, but I would come over and sing him songs that I wrote. And then he got me a deal with RCA as a solo artist in the mid-70s, late 70s. And he produced a couple of my records for RCA, and that was an amazing, amazing time. I had a great band that included Austin DeLone of the Mill Valley Austin DeLones.
Mm-hmm. We have his interview. Very nice man.
We had a wonderful
amazing musician.
Amazing musician. One of the best musicians I've ever played with. And so that was a very heady time for me. And then I wrote this song, Count on Me. We recorded it the next day at Wally Hyder's in San Francisco, where we were recording. I was making a demo, which got me the deal with RCA. And then after I got the deal with RCA, Marty told me that Starship wanted to do the song, you know, wanted to do Count on Me. And I had already had a really great version of it, which myself and the band thought was our hit single. And now here I am with the decision of, do I give this song to the Starship or do I hold on to it for myself, you know, as the artist?
So for those that are listening and may not understand, Marty Balin, founder of Jefferson Airplane, in time that name would change to Jefferson Starship.
Correct.
And the song that you are describing, Count on Me, is one of their big hits. So
right, and so, you know, I was faced with, you know, do I hold on to it for myself or do I let the Starship was a natural. They were going to get the big push. I didn't know if my version was going to get radio airplay or put me on the map, but I instinctively felt that if the Starship did it, that, you know, that they would get the big promotion and the big push.
And so it happened.
I let them do it.
So that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, and so, you know, that song became a hit, and, it was an amazing, amazing time. My album came out on RCA. It didn't do much, and I did another record, a second album for RCA, and that didn't do much, and then I didn't get a chance for a third record. With RCA, and soon after that, I finished my time in Mill Valley. It was probably around 1980, and I left Mill Valley. I had bought a house in Mill Valley with my girlfriend at the time, and I remember packing up and leaving Mill Valley, and that was the end.
That's the house we drove past on Level.
Yeah, that's the house you drove. I bought that with my girlfriend at the time.
And her name?
Helen Cleland.
And how did it feel for you? I always wonder about, you know, it's such a glamorous appearing profession, being a musician, and where everybody, it's not like, well, back then, it was about as cool and hip as any young person growing up in California could imagine, you know, rock, the life of a rock and roll star. Here is your music on the airways, and I mean, Count On Me went far and wide, and it's your song. How does that feel?
Oh, you know, it's a pretty incomparable feeling for someone like, you know, any songwriter to you know. I mean, I have a lot of friends who are really great songwriters, and they just never had a hit. I was really lucky. I haven't, you know, I've had a couple of hits, and to hear your song on the radio, that you know, a song that you wrote in your bedroom, your private thoughts, your private feelings, all of a sudden it's, you know, I mean, imagine how the Beatles must feel, or you know, with Paul, or you know, Stevie Wonder.
I had a Marty Balin.
Yeah, Marty Balin. Marty has, you know, 10 hits, you know, and Marty was, you know, I mean, to be friends with Marty was amazing, because I remember, like, in the summer of 67, when I left The Hate and I moved up to the Russian River, I remember that album, Surrealistic Pillow. I mean, I played that so many times, and I didn't know Marty, but, you know, I always was, you know, and thought he had an amazing voice. There was no one in rock and roll that sounded like Marty. I mean, he just had a distinctive sound, you know? And Surrealistic Pillow was a phenomenal record, and I just remember listening to that record so many times. And so when I finally got to meet Marty, you know, he was like, you know, I mean, I was starstruck, you know, in many ways, because he was a star. You know, he was a larger-than-life presence in so many ways. But, you know, we became really close and really good friends, and we were just people then, you know. When I met Marty, he wasn't in the airplane or the starship. He was kind of taking a break from the rock and roll circus, you know. So I met Marty in a very neutral zone. He wasn't really playing in a band, and, you know, I met him at the right time. He had a lot of time, and we cultivated a really unique friendship and collaboration in the fact that I would write songs that he would sing, you know.
Well, I think Sue Ballin, Marty's wife, described Marty as your biggest fan.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I'll ever have a bigger fan. And, you know, I mean, he used to say things like, Jess, you're the Picasso of rock. I mean, really, come on. you know, I'm not saying that in an ego way. I'm just saying what Marty would say to me, you know?
I think that's what he saw in you.
Yeah, and you know, I've never had anyone believe in me and encourage me and endorse me more than Marty did, you know? And for a guy, you know, like I was, you know, I came up, I wasn't a star in the 60s. I was, you know, Marty was king of the world in the 60s. He, you know, the airplane was, you couldn't get much bigger than that. And I was just, you know, a guy learning to write songs and, you know, going through life trying to scrape together enough money to, you know, to pay the bills and to survive, you know. And Marty was like, that's what, you know, Days of Wonder, the song I wrote before Marty passed, was about, you know, because Marty always used to say, you know, I had the best seat in the house for the 60s. You know, he was, I mean, my God, he was the house band at the Fillmore at Winterland, played the major moments of that culture, Woodstock, Altamont, you know, Monterey Pop Festival. I mean, Marty was amazing things that he saw, and he was the most humble guy. Marty just didn't have that superstar ego. He was just, you know, just a guy that happened to have a beautiful voice, you know.
And at his memorial, there were a handful of people. That was it, and you were one of them. So obviously he had great regard for you, and as was described to me, you were his best friend.
Yeah, you know, I mean, what an honor, you know. I mean, we had had amazing conversations. Like I've never, I mean, you go to a bookstore with Marty, whether it was in New York or down here in Hollywood. I mean, Marty would leave with like 10 books. I mean, he was a voracious reader with the most incredible curiosity about people and biographies of stars from the 30s and 40s. I mean, you know, Marty and I both shared a great love for old film, and we knew a lot of the old character actors and the great casts of and the great directors, and Marty was really enamored with Hollywood of the 30s and 40s and the Golden Age and the Gene Harlows and, you know, the Clark Gables and the stories behind their lives. And, you know, Marty was such an interested person in knowledge and just he had such a curiosity about life, and he was fascinating. I've never met anyone like the guy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm sure that people that got to know him would say the same thing. He was really unique, you know.
Well, I just want to say at this moment how sorry I am for the loss that you experienced with your lifelong friend. And, or, well, I think it qualifies as a lifelong friend. It's been a lot of years.
45 years, that's close enough,
yes,
right?
Yes, right. And so it was a sadness that he died. I nominated him for a Millie after interviewing him a couple of years ago after his medical fiasco, and he was going to come to Mill Valley, and you were going to come to see him receive the Millie Award, and that was not to be. He passed away a couple of weeks before, and what was to be an award ceremony became an award ceremony of which his family accepted on his behalf, but in fact a memorial for him. And that's a sad to say goodbye to your friend.
Yeah, it's death is hard to wrap your head around sometimes. You know, I guess I'll never see that person again. You know, when you think about when was the last time I talked to Marty? When was the last time I saw Marty? You know, I mean, he was such a life force. It's hard to believe he's not on the planet. I mean, he was just such a vortex of energy. You know, he was just the most alive person I have ever known. I mean, he was an actor, a dancer, a singer, a poet, a reader, a scholar, a yogi. He was all these things, and he's irreplaceable.
And he was working on an album with your songs, wasn't he?
Yeah, in fact, Joe Vertino, do you know him?
No.
He was Marty's producer and website guy in Florida, an old friend of Marty's. And he just sent me a list of like 14 songs that Marty had recorded for an upcoming Marty Balancing's Jesse Barish record, which we had been talking about for 30 years, you know. The irony is that he would start this record at this part of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And then not be here anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently he's done, you know, he recorded a bunch of these tracks, but I don't know what state they're in. I don't know how completed they are, and I don't know if Sue wants to continue on and finish them. It, all that is up in the air. I think that's the least of her thoughts right now. You know, she's just trying to heal from this, you know, loss.
Well, when your song Days of Wonder was played at the memorial, it's a beautiful song, and I hope we can get a recording to include with your interview. And who knows, maybe you'll even perform it or something else at the end of this interview. Let's just step away for a moment from your friend, although it's always hard to do so, especially since you really must step away from him. But let's go back to the Mill Valley that you lived in while he was here, living on his house on Blythedale, and you were on Lovell.
Well, I was on Marion for a while. I lived in several places in Mill Valley. I lived in a couple of different houses on, do you know Marion Avenue?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I lived on the bottom of Marion Avenue. Then I lived a little further up on Marion Avenue. This is when I was married. My son was going to Old Mill School. He was, you know, we walked down the steps to Old Mill Park, and, you know, we'd hang out, and 5 years old, and then I ended up getting a divorce, and then a few years later, getting with this other woman, and we bought this house on Lowell.
Mm-hmm.
And Mill Valley was, you know, I've been lucky to be in so many places when they were at the height of their charisma and their magic. You know, Hollywood in the 60s, the Haight-Ashbury, you know, Oak Berkeley in the 60s, and then Mill Valley and Marin in the 70s was like, you know, you couldn't have asked for a more special place to be.
Well, describe your world then, and the places you went to and the people you saw.
Well, you know, Marty's little house on Blythedale was like the focus of a lot of my travels, but I would hang out at Davoud's, which was like the local coffee place. There was a place above the physical therapy center. I don't know if you remember that place.
You mean on the corner of the...
It used to be the Moody Blues, and then above that.
Right, okay, so if we were to put that in present time, it is still a spa area, and it's above Equator Coffee and Teas, and
right,
Davoud
right.
is where D'Angelo's is.
Right, and back then, my daily ritual was I would take a sauna every morning to wash away all the drugs and alcohol that I was was fueling myself with.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
I think that's what saved my life in a lot of ways, that I would take saunas every day, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There was a great sauna place above the Equator bookstore, which is whatever it is now, the coffee shop in La Ginestra.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I'd take saunas and then just go have a latte at Davoud's and just hang out, you know, just go to Marty's house, work on songs, and then, you know, I had a band. I put a band together. I had a band for several years, and that Audie was the keyboard player, and Jack O'Hara was the original guitar player. So basically, I had Eggs Over Easy as my band.
Mm-hmm.
You know Eggs Over Easy, right?
Yes, that was with Austin DeLone, too.
Right, so Austin DeLone and Jack O'Hara were like the foundation of Eggs Over Easy, and when I started my band, both those guys were in it. So I had an amazing band, and I had a great shot, and unfortunately it didn't take me to the heights of where I dreamed I could go, but it was, you know, it was such a great time to be in Mill Valley in those days. I couldn't have imagined anything more magical than living in that little town and, you know, hanging out and walking those streets of Mill Valley, which I did religiously.
Mm-hmm. You talked about drugs and alcohol, and that in the time in the 70s and up to the 80s, there was a lot of drugs in Mill Valley.
Yeah, there were a lot of drugs. There were, you know, people got into freebasing, which I never did. You know, my downfall happened to be Quaaludes for some crazy reason. I got into those really heavy and just messed up my life in a lot of ways. You know, some people bottomed out on alcohol or freebase or coke or, you
know. There was coke everywhere in Mill Valley. Do you remember? It was just snowing in this town in the late 70s and early 80s.
When I left Mill Valley in 1980, was just the beginning of the freebase thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I never really got into that. I was never into cocaine that much. I did my share of it, believe me.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't my drug of choice. You know, now I haven't touched anything for, oh God, 20 years. I don't drink, I don't smoke pot, I don't, you know, I just don't do anything. I played that one out.
And how about the rock and roll lifestyle? I mean, sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
What about it?
Well, what about it?
Yeah, no, well, was the you know, it was every boy's dream, wasn't it? You know, I mean, to be able to play music was, I still consider, oh my God, I get to do this, you know? I mean, every day still, I get up and the first thing I do every day is I sing for an hour. I play guitar, I work on old songs, I wrote a new song today. I just, you know, they just come out. I don't really try to write them. I just have this thing that I can do. I don't consider it, you know, I consider somebody who can fix a car, you know, that's way more impressive to me in a way than writing songs, because writing songs, I guess, to the guy who can fix a car, that's just in his nature, you know, to be able to do that, or a dentist who can, you know, do the things that they do is like an amazing, so, you know, writing songs to me is just second nature. It's just something that I now do, and I do that every day. You know, I sing for an hour, I work on songs, and I never take it for granted. I always think, wow, you know, I am really lucky.
But you know, there were a lot of casualties back in the 70s and 80s. I recall there's a few musicians, I won't say names, but that I personally have known, and who, you know, they fell down a well of drug and alcohol abuse.
Yeah.
And beautifully.
You know, you can make a list of just people that lived in Mill Valley that you know. But it was, and even the, you know, the great ones, the Hendrixes and the Jim Morrisons and the you know, Janis Joplins, and, you know, they just succumbed to, you know, they had access to unlimited amounts of drugs and alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Do you think their fame was the undoing of them? Or do you think it was, they were just the ones of notoriety that succumbed to the temptations that...
You know, I think people that became really famous, like Janis and Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, you know, just to name a few, I think, you know, they were basically very solitary, lonely people. And the fame and fortune just accentuated their isolation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Janis would, you know, after singing for thousands of people, would always go back to her hotel room alone. And I think, you know, I think that was an interesting conundrum for people that, you know, became quote-unquote famous.
Did you ever find that your degree of fame affected your life one way or another?
Not really, because I never was, you know, famous, you know, I never was like, you know, couldn't walk down the street. I mean, even now, you know, if I tell people I wrote Count on Me, half the people don't know what I'm talking about, you know. They think I wrote Down on Me by Janis. Or if I say I wrote Hearts, they, oh, you mean the girl, the band with the two sisters? No. Hearts. You know, they think I said Heart, the band.
Right, exactly.
So, I mean, you know, I've never had the problem of being too famous, really. You know, that's, I guess, one of the perks of being a songwriter. You're in the background and, you know, you don't have to deal with the, you know, that kind of thing.
And as far as your time living in Mill Valley, during that wild drug-infused time, what possessed you to stop, you know, not have to take saunas, but actually decide that this is not the lifestyle for me?
It took me a long time, you know, to come to that conclusion. I mean, I smoked pot for years, and I didn't really enjoy it that much after a while. You know, I just did it in a habitual way. It didn't really, you know, it just became a way to stay numb, and I didn't like that feeling anymore. And I tried to stop for many years. You know, by this time I had worked through my Quaalude thing. I wasn't really drinking that much. I would, you know, drink sometimes, you know, when I'd go out at night, but I wasn't an alcoholic by any stretch of the imagination. But I did struggle with pot for a long time, because, you know, when you keep doing something that's not making you feel really good and you keep doing it, it's like, well, why am I doing this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I finally stopped smoking pot about 20 years ago. you know, and I had stopped many times, but I would always start again thinking I could control it. I mean, some people, there's people that drink alcohol and they're social drinkers. They can have a glass of wine at night, a martini, a couple of martinis, and they're fine. They're not alcoholics. And then there's the alcoholic who has a negative connection to alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
I had the same thing with marijuana. You know, I had an addictive connection with it. It wasn't like I could take a smoke a little at night and you know, I was okay. It was like it was an addiction, you know. And people say, oh, it's not really an addicting. It is addicting, trust me.
I remember my grandfather, who was lived in Chicago way back in the 20s and 30s and 40s, and he used to say that the jazz musicians did a lot of coke and pot, marijuana.
Yeah.
Way back when.
Yeah, that was the jazz musician drug of choice, and then it became heroin, you know, in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
All those great players, you know, all went through a heroin, you know, Coltrane and Miles Davis all went through a heroin period, you know.
Did you ever lose any friends during the 70s and those drug-infused years here in Mill Valley? Were there people where you just said, that's it, I can't be with them anymore?
I don't think I was one of those people, so I'm sure people said that about me.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, there were a lot of casualties along the way. There were, I can't remember names, and you probably don't want to hear.
Well, we can say names if they're dead, I guess. I mean, when we sat down, finally to have just a friendly conversation, it became clear that we had some friends in common.
Right.
Characters so, like Don
were,
Lewis.
There were a lot of people, you know, I've lost lots of people along on this journey, you know, on my 73 years on this planet, you know, a lot of people have gone, not just from drugs, but, you know, from just sickness and disease and cancer and whatever, you know, heart attacks. But there have been many, many drug overdoses and people that, especially in those days in Mill Valley, it was such a wild time with all the dealers and you know the Trident and
you described in your pre-interview chat, you described the smuggler scene here. How did you describe it? Where they lived?
Just the houses on the Maseratis and the Oriental rugs and the gold Buddhas.
It's so true.
And there were a whole group of those people, you know.
Uh-huh.
I was kind of the token songwriter guy, you know. I was kind of like, hey, sing a song, Jesse. Here's some Thai sticks.
we'll perform for pot.
Yeah, exactly. I was like the trained songwriter on a chain. Here. Here's some Thai sticks. Sing. Yes, Master, whatever you want.
The song Count On Me, I didn't ask you, but it does, you know, now that I have the opportunity, that's a lovely song. Maybe you'd sing a few stanzas of it, but how did that song came to come to be? Is it a story behind that song?
You know, I was living up on the Marion Avenue. My marriage had just, my 11-year marriage, had, you know, tanked, and my wife moved out and left me with my son to take care of, which was difficult because I was trying to put my, you know, this band together, and a career was sort of happening. And Count On Me, just, you know, I just wrote it. It was kind of like a goodbye song to my wife, in a way, you know, I'll always be there for you, we'll always be friends, and we still are, you know,
mm-hmm.
That's how true love and real love should be, you know, you shouldn't hate your partner if they don't want to be with you anymore,
mm-hmm.
Just let them go, hey, go, you know what I mean, but a lot of people, you know, use their kids as weapons, and, stay bitter for the rest of their lives about other people, you know,
mm-hmm.
about partners and well, you know, I would count on me kind of to my ex-wife to be mm-hmm. like as you know, and I knew it was like a special song. Like I said, I recorded. I was doing a demo, and I went in the studio the next day, and we recorded it like live with Marty singing on it. And my version ended up on my, you know, was the song that one of the songs that got me the deal with RCA. I did like a little 3-song demo, and that was the song, one of the songs of the three that got me the deal. And it was the song that me and the band always thought was our hit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was like my version still is very magical. It just had a magic about it. I had just written it the night before, went in the studio, and we just recorded it, and it just had a vibe, you know. It wasn't as polished and as sonically correct as the Starship's version, but my version had something really unique, you know. It was my song. I wrote it, and it meant something me personally.
How about Hearts? What's the story behind that song?
Hearts. I was in Mill Valley. I was living in Mill Valley, late 70s, and it was at the height of my Quaalude addiction. You know, I had a really bad Quaalude habit. And my girlfriend, at the time, we were living in that house on Lovell that you saw.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, you know, you need to clean up your act. You need to go to L.A. and, you know, clean up your act because I can't deal with you anymore. You know, I was really quite a mess at the time. And so I went to L.A. I drove to L.A., stayed with my mom. And, you know, so this is how screwed up I was. I was going to clean up my act, but I took 100 Quaaludes with me. A typical Marin County musician, right? Anyway, I ended up in L.A., and I guess I hit one of many bottoms that I hit in my life. I was at my mom's, and I remember waking up in the middle of the night. I flushed all the Quaaludes down the toilet. I had really long hair like I have now, and I cut it all off by myself in the middle of the night. I gave myself like the worst haircut you could ever imagine. And I stayed in L.A. for another month, and I was visiting a friend before I went back to Mill Valley with my new look, you know, because people knew me as like the long-haired guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now I was going to come back with this like... I don't know, it was like a bad Mia Farrow do or something. And
and you have a long, narrow face.
Yeah, and people knew me as this, you know, this one, that's the look I had cultivated, mm-hmm. you know. I was kind of like the John Cipollina lookalike.
Tall, thin, long
yeah,
hair.
Tall, thin, long hair guy, mm-hmm. you know. And so I stayed in L.A. another, like, 3 or 4 weeks before I went up, and I was at a friend's. I was really depressed, you know, because I'm coming off all these Quaaludes that I'd been taking, and I was staying at my mom's in the Valley, and I was visiting an old friend of mine who I had played with in many years before, a drummer who had passed away a few years later. His name was Kevin Kelly. He actually was in the Byrds, and his cousin was Chris Hillman. He was in the Sweetheart of the Rodeo version of the Byrds, which was a seminal album in the folk rock, you know, what started the whole Eagles kind of vibe,
mm-hmm.
you know, country rock.
Mm-hmm.
It was like the first of that kind of album. And I was visiting him, and for some reason I had a little parking stub, like from a parking lot, and I started writing, "Is everything all right?" I just called to say, I started writing Hearts, which I never really write the lyrics first. I always write the music first, and for some reason, and I still have that piece of, I found that years later, and I framed it. I have it on my wall.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back to my mom's house that night with those little fragment of a lyric, and I wrote Hearts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Of which Marty Balin put out into the airways.
Right, and then and he that was his first big, like a big hit of his solo career, his first big hit on the EMI album, Marty Balin. And, you know, when I wrote it, I didn't, you know, when I wrote Count on Me, I thought it was really commercial. I thought it could be a hit song. When I wrote Hearts, I didn't necessarily think it was a hit, but I thought it was really unique. Something about the way the melody played off the chords. And I played it, I can't remember being excited to play it for Marty, and he went, "I don't know, Jeff, I don't know if that's one of your better songs." And you were wrong, Marty. But anyway, see, not everybody knows everything, right?
No, it's hard to know everything, but you can pretend you do.
Yeah, but I gave him the song, and then he ended up recording it, and they did a magical version of it, and it became one of his signature songs, and people to this day love that song, you know?
Yes, it's kind of one of those iconic songs. When we were talking before, you talked about Davoud's being your office.
Davoud, yes.
Yes, the restaurant Davoud's, which was really quite a place. You could get a very good cup of coffee, an excellent croissant, great Mediterranean food.
And they had like an amazing seafood salad.
Yes.
With crab or shrimp.
Was that your office, Jesse?
What's that?
Was that really
yes,
your office?
Yes, it was my office. That was... That was where I spent a lot of time. You know, I'd just go there in the morning, I'd leave, I'd come back, you know, smoking Shermans and drinking coffee. That's when you could smoke in restaurants, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And
who would have been in there with you in the restaurant? Who would have been sitting next to you if
some
I
of those were? Smugglers.
Can we say names or not?
No, we better not. I'll draw the line right there. No, there would be, you know, carpenters from David Crosby's house. There'd be other musicians. There'd be the waitresses that we all had the crushes on, you know. There'd be Davoud running around like a lunatic, doing whatever Davoud did, you know, keeping the place in order. I don't know, you know.
Do you remember how early town shut down back then?
Do I remember what?
How early things sounded. It became quiet in the evening. Now Mill Valley.
Oh my God! It was like it was so depressing. Except for like, for me, I would go from the old mill to Sweetwater.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was my route. I wasn't really a 2 a.m. club guy or a Brothers guy. You know.
Mm-hmm.
I stayed in town at night and went, you know, drank at Sweetwater and stumbled down to the old mill, then stumbled back to Sweetwater. And then somehow stumbled home. Oh, now that I think about it, how did I survive?
Jesse, if you and I were walking together back in time and into Davoud's restaurant, and there you sat at the counter. Remember they had the counter?
They had a counter. I would usually sit at a table off to the right. You know, I'd grab a table and order one of their famous, you know, lattes in the mug.
Mm-hmm, big mug.
Big mug of a coffee latte, you know, and smoke a few cigarettes, wait to see who would come in, you know. That was, okay, so were you...
Okay, so you and I are walking in. We're friends now, and I was here at that time, too. I very likely saw you in Davoud's.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it was a favorite place of mine as well. We walked in there, and there you're sitting, your young self, with either the Mia Farrow haircut or the long look you had before. And you saddle up right next to your younger self, and you decide to tell him a thing or two. What would you say?
I would say, enjoy the ride, dude. It don't last forever.
And what would your young self say to you, your old self?
I'd say, hey, old man, what are you talking about? No, I would say to my young self, hey, enjoy the ride, be here now, don't worry, be happy. All the platitudes we grew up with, you know, they really mean something, you know. And but back then, I lived in my head and in a world of drugged out bliss. You know, I was loaded all the time, you know, on something, you know, like smoking weed or Quaaludes or coffee or booze. I mean, you know, I was constantly medicating myself, which is interesting because now I've been like living the sober life for, I don't know if that's what you want to call it, but for the last 20 or so years. And, you know, I'm around people that smoke, and I have no desire to get high anymore.
Well, you look like the healthiest guy on the planet. Clear eyes.
I feel healthy. Amazing that I've done the things that I've done to myself, you know, drug-wise and lifestyle choices, and that I still look like a reasonable facsimile of that younger guy.
So if, before we end this interview, let's just remember some of the people of the town of that time. When you were walking around town in 79, there would have been a few people of note that you would see again and again. Can you remember some of the people you would see?
There was Charlie Deal, the toilet seat guitar maker. He was always like the town character, the sweetest guy you'd ever want to meet. There were, you know, the musicians like Austin DeLone and Jack O'Hara, Johnny DeCaro, who later became Marty's guitar player, who I introduced to Marty and who was in my band. Dougie Kilmer, who passed away, my bass player. There was Mickey from the Unknown Museum. Do you remember him?
Mm-hmm. And the museum.
And the what?
And the museum.
Yeah, Mickey had the Unknown Museum guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was him.
Mm-hmm. That wonderful museum.
Wonderful, and he was a great character.
He's still around, not dead yet.
He is still around?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he is in San Rafael, or I read some article about it. Well, you know, he was one of the local characters. David Peterson in his vintage cars was, you know, and all of his girlfriends, he was running around in those days. Joel Cornoglia, one of the carpenters who actually was, you know, the house sitter up at Crosby's, you know, lived up there.
Greenwood Way.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And he was kind of like the caretaker when Crosby was out of town or on the road. You know, that whole crew of carpenters, I remember a character named Nino, who used to play backgammon in the front window of Daboud's. You know, characters, all characters.
No women, though. I haven't heard a woman's name mentioned yet.
Well, you know, there were plenty of them. There were, you know, there were the girls that worked at you know, I was married for a lot of that time, so I was, you know, wasn't really available to, you know, to date. And I would never stay single for long back then. You'd always, you know, I would find the next person that was going to share in my neurotic vision, you know. But there were, you know, all the people that you knew at Davoud's, the women, the waitresses, you know, Julie and Kathy. I mean, I remember their last names.
Mean, we're talking about the people I know, Julie Burial and Kathy Cavalli.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Marty's, the woman that he was with at the time, Trish. You met her at the memorial.
Mm-hmm.
That was who Marty was with when I met him.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you know, there weren't the influx of new women like there are in L.A. You know, like in L.A., in Venice, in Santa Monica, every day I go out, there's a whole new crop of people, men, women. You know, in Mill Valley in the 70s, it was kind of static. You know, there weren't that many new people showing up.
I guess it was early recycling always. An efficient community. There were people, certain people. Well, perhaps just in that era.
Yeah, in the 70s, I just meant, you know, there weren't not that many new people showed up, men or women. It was kind of like a little tightly knit crew of people, you know. And there were women musicians. There was a woman named Tucky. There was, Anna Rizzo. There was Ronnie Raines. I don't know if you know those people.
Mm-mm.
You know, there were, you know, there was Jewel. people.
Sounds like there was a pretty strong community.
Yeah, it was a strong community, and there wasn't that many transitory people. You know, it wasn't like, it was like you'd see the people that lived in Mill Valley.
Mm-hmm. When you came here for Marty's memorial, you seemed a little shell-shocked by the Mill Valley that you came back to.
Well, yeah, it was pretty shocking, all right. I mean, I had the last time I was in Mill Valley was maybe 20 years ago for another memorial for my bass player, Doug Kilmer, who passed away, and they had his memorial at the original Sweetwater. And back then, it was starting to change, but not as much and as drastically as it felt to me this time. You know, I mean, this time, every place that I remembered was gone, except for, I mean, back when I came back here for Doug Kilmer's memorial, there was still Village Music was there.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, John was there, and that was kind of a familiar anchor for me. But this time, everything was changed. The only thing that, like I said, the only thing that was the same was the Mill Valley Market and the movie theater.
Mm-hmm.
But everything, you know, Sanapa Farms, the little antique shop next to the movie theater, and Acura TV on the corner, right across from Village Music, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the things that made it a quaint little funky town were gone, and it was all like, it was someone's version of what they thought a cute little town should look like.
Do you think you'll come back and visit?
Do I?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm sure in my life I'd never say never, you know. I mean, it's a beautiful area, but I have too many ghosts there, you know, too many memories that make me sad in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're there and you live there like you and Willie have been there, and it's, you see it change gradually. But for me, it was, you know, all the people and the moments, they're all good. There's no Davoud, there's no physical therapy center, there's no, you know, Golden Valley Market, there's no, you know, all the touchstones for me were gone, you know, so it kind of made me feel kind of blue, to be honest with you.
I do hope that you will give Mill Valley another chance.
I love Mill Valley. I loved it then, and there's something that will always remain magical about it. You know, it's a beautiful place. Just the Mill Valley that I knew, the people, places, that I have to let go of that, you know?
Yeah.
And accept it for what it is. I mean, Marty had that ability. He could go to Mill Valley even now. He'd still love it, you know? He had that ability to go with the changes and accept the inevitable, transitory nature of life. You know, for some reason, I held on. You know, Marty didn't hang out that much in town. I don't think I ever saw Marty in Sweetwater or the old mill or Davoud's. You know, Marty stayed pretty much to himself in that little house on Blydale. He'd take walks with John, his dog. Or, you know, but he wasn't a townie, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I was like a townie. I was like on the streets of Mill Valley, you know, looking for whatever I was looking for in those days.
Yeah.
Marty had already found what he wanted and was trying to get away from it. You know, he was trying to stay in his little, he had created a beautiful little space there on Blythedale, you know, and people came to him.
Right, that's how he described it in his interview. People would show up.
Yeah, it was just like I said, you didn't know who was going to show up there, and his house was like a magnet, so it was always an adventure going over there, and, you know.
Well, we have the Throckmorton Theater, and we have the Sweetwater and the new location, and I know your music is, after listening to the song you wrote for Marty 2 weeks before he died, I can only hope that you will come and share your music with the people that live here now, because I know that they would appreciate that.
Well, you know, I leave myself open to whatever this life, wherever it takes me, you know. I mean, the trees, the, you know, the ambiance of Mount Tamalpais, and, you know, there's a magic there. The Bay Area, the city, it's, you know, it's special. I'm just, you know, I'm just in another place right now, and so I just accept everything for where it is and what it is now, you know.
I have one final question for you before concluding this interview, and hoping that you'll conclude with a song, but is there anything that we haven't talked about that you'd like to talk about? Have we missed anything in this interview?
Let's see here. I can't think. I think we've covered everything except, you know, the state of my teeth.
The state of your what?
My teeth.
You have a lovely smile. They look good.
Thank you. I have a lot of money invested in those. No, I think we've covered, you know, I mean, I'm other than the fact that, you know, I take extremely good care of myself now. For someone who has abused themselves religiously, now I've been a raw foodist for over 20 years. I don't eat any animals. I love the little critters and refuse to eat them. I'm just trying to be here as long as I can because I'm still having fun.
Jesse, will you sing a song for us?
I'll sing you. Okay, hold on. Let me move myself over to a place where I can do this, okay?
Okay.
Hold on 1 second. How about, Deborah, if I sing a little bit of Count on Me for you?
That would be wonderful.
That would be the song that Starship made a hit out of in 1978 and was, you know, a pivotal, seminal song for me. So here it goes. I'm gonna sit here and I'll play it for you, and I hope you can hear it, okay?
Okay.
Here it comes.
Precious love, I'll give to you. You as the sky, deep in the eyes of a love so true. Beautiful face, you make me feel right on the stairs, lost in the air of a love so real. And you can count. Count on my love, darling. You can count on me. You can count on my love. See it through. Emerald eyes, China perfume, caught on the wheel, lost in the feel of a love so true. Ruby lips, will you make my song into the night, saved by the light of a love so strong. You can count on me. You can count on my love, darling. You can count on me. You can count on my love. Precious love, I'll give.
So beautiful.
Could you hear it okay?
Not perfect, but good enough.
Okay.
Just beautiful, and I have to agree with you. There's something about your rendition. Just beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's funny. My sister has two sons, right?
Mm-hmm.
One of the sons lost his wife
mm-hmm.
2 weeks ago. The other son, Matt, he's a publicist. Works for comedians. He's pretty successful. Anyway, he was in New York several years ago having dinner with a woman that he had met in New York. He was on business and she was on business. She was also living in L.A. and they were on a date, and my nephew's probably in his same age as my son. He's about 50, and this girl was in her 30s. Back then, he was probably in his mid-40s, and she was in her late 30s, and they were having dinner, and she always says the date wasn't going very well. And then out of nowhere, she said to him, my favorite song of all time is Count on Me. And my nephew said, my uncle wrote that. And she said the date went from a C- to an A+, and they got married. And a few years ago, they asked me to sing that song at their wedding, which I did, which I sang kind of just the way I sang just now. And that was pretty interesting, right?
That's about as cool can be for a song. I mean,
this is a woman who, didn't grow up in that era, but she, and every time I see her, even last time at the funeral of her sister-in-law, she said, I was obsessed with that song. I don't know why. I was just obsessed with it. And when I went out with Matt, the date wasn't going good, and I just said, my favorite, and he goes, my uncle wrote that.
But that's the thing, isn't it, about music? It can be magic. It can change your life. It can get you through difficult times. It can inspire you.
It's been my, through everything, through all this, the tale I just told you, which I don't know how long I've been talking, but I pretty much covered my, from Brooklyn to the whole deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
But music has been the only thing I could ever really count on. I mean, I could count on my mom, but that's what Jewish mothers are there for.
Mm-hmm.
You could always count on your mom. You could commit murder and your mom would forgive you.
Mm-hmm.
And you could say, oh, he was having a bad day.
But it is beautiful that you have this relationship with music and that it affects so many people on so many levels.
Yeah.
And that it also, helped seal the deal with your nephew and his
wife. Yeah, and they're married and they have a wonderful life together, and so through it all, through all the relationships and broken hearts and sadness and stuff that I've been through with women and just disappointments in life and dreams that didn't come true and all of that, I could always count on music. I can always sit down with a guitar and sing. I can always write one more song, even if it sounds like a bunch of my other songs, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
I I just think of, wow, I'm luckier than a sultan in Arabia.
As my father, the Jewish father, would say, it's a mitzvah.
Yeah, and another thing, it's interesting. I have one of my dearest friends is a rabbi here in L.A., right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's also a musician and a songwriter, and he's worked at record companies, and now he's a rabbi, Rabbi Jay,
Mm-hmm.
And he called me a few days ago and said, I was driving with my son. He has a son, Asher, who's in his 20s and is an amazing musician. They said they heard Hearts on the radio, and they were just blown away, but they didn't remember how beautiful it was. And he's taken the melody of Hearts and put made it into a Jewish prayer for the the people that were killed in Pittsburgh.
Wow.
They took that melody and he put Baruch Hashem Shachadeh. I don't know. I don't speak Hebrew. You know what I'm saying? But
mm-hmm.
And they were going to sing.
sometimes a beautiful song comes out of a person's heart or their thoughts, and then it takes on a life of its own. And obviously, yeah, that's happened. They're like your children, I suppose.
Yeah, and it, you know, like I said, you know, I've written lots and lots of songs, and only a couple of them have become like quote unquote hits. It's not easy to do that, you know. It's not easy to launch a song out into the atmosphere and have it touch so many people, you know. Like I said, I have a lot of friends who are really good songwriters, but they haven't had that lucky moment, you know,
Stop writing, Jesse. The song for Marty, which, you know, that seems like a more complicated song. I don't know if you can sing it now or not, but I'll certainly like to include that with this interview.
Well, you play include the version that I gave you, you know. If you need me, I can send you an MP3 of it or something.
We'll do that.
You know, it's just a little harder for me to play that one right now.
Yes. Well, Jesse, I want to thank you for sharing your life story with us. It was interesting and beautiful, and you certainly have caught the waves of so many different scenes, so many different times. Thank you for sharing, to bringing alive to
hey,
those.
Thank you for asking me those cool questions. I mean, you were a great interviewer. I mean, you really pulled out of me. You were really curious about that journey that I've been on from Brownsville to Catskills, you know, the whole you know, journey of through all those places, and, you know, it really took me, it kind of was emotional living, you know, going through that again.
Yes, you've had a remarkable life.
Who do I thank? You know, thank the universe, Hashem, whoever's up there, you know, pulling the strings, I don't know.
Well, I thank you for sharing your story and for making a time in Mill Valley's past alive again. And I do hope that we'll see you.
You will. I had a great time, and hanging out with you and Willie was the high point. I mean, I loved my little room, and whatever changes I went through about, you know, with the Mill Valley not being the same as I remember it, it's all part of the acceptance of life, you know,
yep.
How it is. You can't hold on to the past, you know, and change is just inevitable.
Well, if you decide to come back, you can count on us.
How can I get that in writing?
You've got it, brother. Okay, well, this concludes the interview on behalf of the Mill Valley Public Library and the Mill Valley Historical Society. I thank you so much for this time, and keep on playing.
Thank you, Deborah. Give my love to Willie, and we'll catch up with you somewhere along the trail, you know?
Somewhere along the trail. We'll see where the day and the trail leads us.
I love it.